Thinking about joining us in Indianapolis for the Gospel Coalition's 2024 Women's Conference? The regular rate price of $239 goes up to $259 on May 8th. This is your final chance to save on your registration. Join us June 20th through the 22nd to feast together on the words of Jesus with keynote messages from Jen Wilkin, Melissa Kruger, David Platt, and more, and featuring worship music led by Shane and Shane. Sign up before the price increases on May 8th at tgcw24.org.
Welcome to As in Heaven, Season 3. My name is Jim Davis. I am your host and pastor of Orlando Grace Church. I am joined by our guest, Patrick Miller, today. I got to know Patrick fairly recently from the Good Faith Debate Season 2, where you and Jay Kim did an outstanding job of arguing should a church be slow or quick to embrace new technologies. And we are going to come back to that again toward the end of it, because it is central to what we want to talk about here today. Patrick is one of the pastors at the Crossing Church in Columbia, Missouri. He is co-host of the podcast Truth Over Tribe, and he also has a book with that same title, Truth Over Tribe. It came out in 2022, and man, I'm excited to be able to hang out today and talk, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there about de-churching that we hope today's conversation will bring clarity to. If you follow much of the online discourse over the past few years, one of the biggest things that you might one of the big conversations you might have heard about is deconstruction. That term is broad and difficult to nail down. Sometimes it means leaving the faith altogether. For others, it just means leaving certain important doctrines behind. For others, it means just disentangling the actual gospel from unhelpful subcultural politics or unethical matters. So that conversation is an important conversation that we need to have, but it isn't the conversation that we're going to have here today. It's related to it, but it's not core to it. If this is your first episode listening to this season, then by means of a quick backstory, our podcast team conducted the most comprehensive and detailed quantitative study, a national study of de-churching in America, before recording the season, and we learned a lot. We learned a lot about where they're going. We learned a lot about why they're leaving. We learned some things about how they might come back. We learned that most people left the church not because they were deconstructing, super angry, or had been egregiously wronged in some way, although that is a subset of people who are leaving the church. Because deconstruction is a little bit tricky to put a precise number on, it's our best guess that only about 25% left the church in a really hurt way. Hence, in our forthcoming book, The Great De-Churching, we have elected to coin two new terms. And I want to give Skylar Flowers credit for these terms, but we kind of divided these de-churched two groups into what we call the church casualties and the casually de-churched. The casually de-churched are about three times the size of the de-churched casualties, and those are the ones that left with significant hurt. On the other hand, the casually de-churched are people who moved to a new place, life got busy, they never plugged in, COVID hit maybe, they didn't go to church for 18 months, didn't really miss their Sunday mornings at church, they picked up new hobbies, golf, fishing, line dancing, whatever it is that people do on Sunday mornings. But we learned a lot about this crew, what they believe. We'll get into that, what might bring them back. So today's episode, we want to really focus on this much larger and arguably far less understood, and I think what the data says is maybe even much easier to reach group of the casually de-churched. So I have my co-host here, Michael Graham, today. Patrick, on behalf of both of us, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, my first question for you, Patrick, is when Mike started getting the data back from Ryan Burge and his team on the study and was sharing some of the insights on the casually dechurched, you were involved in that process. You were aware of what we're learning, and in many cases helping us sift through what we were learning. What were some of your first reactions to the data on the casually dechurched?
Well, I was shocked. I think like most pastors, I knew that something was happening, but I didn't know precisely what was happening. And perhaps because I do a lot of work in kind of cultural apologetics, I had this sense that probably most people were leaving the church for culture warring reasons. And that's really tough because resolving those, it sometimes feels insoluble. How can you help someone move from a political position A into a less militarized position? And as Mike was talking to me, on one level, it gave me hope because I realized that my perception that people were leaving the church for, again, these cultural reasons, or as you said, they were a casualty of the church, church hurt, that kind of thing. I thought that was the vast majority. And when it came to understand that, no, the vast majority are people who are casually de-churching, again, this gave me hope because if they were still open to coming back to church, if they were still interested in returning to church, it was going to be much easier to welcome those people in. I think on the other side of that, I felt this sense of missional calling. I mean, if we are going through one of the largest religious shifts in American history, which you guys have proved, yes, we absolutely are, we have a missional calling to reach people who are walking away from God. And this is really an intergenerational calling in my mind. You know, for Gen Z, we aren't bringing them back. We aren't bringing them back to church. We're bringing them to church for the first time. And for their parents and those who have left the church casually, again, we might be bringing them back to the church, but it's going to be a key part of reaching that younger generation to welcome in older generations who are leaving for the reasons that you guys laid out.
When our initial data set was coming in, it definitely made you sit back because of all the things that you'd expect to be there with respect to people who are, you know, had tremendously painful experiences. And I do want to just kind of speak to everybody here, too, with respect to this particular episode. We are going to get to the people who have had significant church hurt and these different kinds of things in about 2 weeks. So we have no interest in ignoring, minimizing, or patronizing de-church casualties. Okay, it's just the scope of, you know, our episode here today is on the much larger and arguably far less understood casually de-churching group. So, as Jim kind of alluded to, you know, in his intro, some of the top reasons why the casual de-churched people left the church were things like moving, attendance wasn't convenient, COVID-19 got them out of the habit, they had other priorities for their time and money, they chose to worship online, and divorce, remarriage, or some other significant family change. So there's a lot of people who are out there who have just kind of been adrift, literally tens of millions of people. So some of them are quite orthodox and others are hit and miss doctrinally, but there's so many people that just kind of quietly walked out the back door of the church and just haven't come back. So yes, there are some other things in there for many of them, you know, some relational tension, some political tension, some other things they might have disagreed with either the clergy or with the church or individual people. But when you drill down, those issues don't really seem to be the driving force for this three quarters of, you know, the whole de-churching phenomenon. And so it isn't easy to kind of put your finger squarely on one particular thing. But if you had to, you know, probably the word apathy is the word that would kind of encapsulate most of what you'd think about in terms of casually de-churching, in terms of most of these people having in common. Church wasn't just wasn't working for them, and so they walked. And so, Patrick, I have a question for you with respect to, you know, your context in, you know, Columbia, Missouri, which is obviously a college town. You got Mizzou there in the city. Have you observed many people who have casually de-churched in your city?
It's a great question because I can only answer it with retrospect. One of the problems is that when people are leaving, whether it's because of church hurt or, as I alluded to earlier, culture war issues, they tend to leave rather loudly. And as a pastor, that draws a lot of your attention because these might be people that you care deeply about. These might be people who are saying difficult things about your church. And so naturally, you're just going to be fixated on that. But when you started pointing out this group of casually de-churched people, I started in retrospect thinking through people who had left the church over the last, you know, even 5 to 10 years. And I realized there was a very large subset of people who just quietly exited. And it was hard to track because it was, at least in my experience, never very sudden. It would be maybe they stopped attending their small group. Maybe then they stopped serving. Maybe then they stopped attending Sunday morning worship. And at each of those points, you try to grab those people, you try to welcome them back in. And they would often say things like, oh, I just need a break for now. I'm going to come back. But slowly over time, they would drift off, which is actually much harder to deal with pastorally because it's almost easy to allow them to drift off because you don't want to be forceful or pressuring people to do things that you want them to do. And so I started talking to other pastors in our town to see if they were experiencing the same thing. And they had the exact same experience. I said, I hadn't even thought of this before. But now that you're describing it, I can name multiple families in my church who left in that exact manner. And so that's why I think this is such a helpful category, is because, again, it's not a loud category. It's a quiet category. It's a slow category. And those are precisely the kinds of categories that tend to fall off our map.
So I want to follow that up because you I'm always amazed when I talk with you or text with you, like you have good numbers behind what you, better numbers than most. It's not just anecdotal. And so what percentage would you say in your college town context have casually de-churched versus de-churched casualties? And let me have a second part to that. You're in a larger church context. We're kind of in a medium church context. You're networking with smaller churches too. How does the size of the church affect the nature of the people who casually de-church?
Well, in some ways, I think this can be a larger problem for a large church. I mean, to state the obvious, one thing that draws people to large churches is that they can worship somewhat anonymously. They can check things out for a little bit. They're not going to be greeted right away and invited into things immediately. And there's a beauty to that because sometimes there are people who are in process and they need some space to just try it on for a little bit and think before they want to take that next big social step in their life of really embedding their lives inside of a church. But again, in a large church context, the opposite can be true as well, which is as people are casually leaving, it's easier not to catch it. It's easier not to see it. Now, speaking on a broad citywide level, I don't think I could give any hard numbers because obviously I only have access to our own church. Now, we have some really specific numbers in terms of how COVID affected de-churching in our environment. And so we can talk about that in just a second. But just anecdotally speaking, talking to pastors, this is a pattern that's not just happening at our church. It's large churches, it's medium churches, it's small churches. And so everyone I know is seeing people, you know, de-church quietly. And I think this is especially possible in college towns because, as you can imagine, a college student comes to the university and they have to make a choice. Am I going to go to church? And that's a huge inflection point for them. They might start de-churching from the minute they arrive on campus. But we see the other thing happen as well, which is that they might get involved their freshman year, but slowly over time, they begin to drift off or drift away. Similar things go for people in their 20s and beyond. So while I can't give a super hard number of what's the percentage inside our exact city, what I can say is that it's a pattern that as I talk to pastors, I see across the board. And COVID is really the key here because what COVID did, at least in our church and in other churches, is it took that pattern of people casually de-churching and it put it on steroids. We saw something that we've never seen before. And it was exceptionally hard to track because depending on, you know, when your city opened up and how long you had to worship online versus in person, you really might not know that someone had de-churched because it happened over a period of a year or a year and a half when there was lots of people not coming back to church for health reasons.
One of the things that was so interesting in the study, Burge and I really looked at this, is since you're in a college town and the majority of my ministry context has been in college towns, we found that students who are involved both in church and a campus ministry are 3 times more likely to stay in the church after college. Now, some of that involves self-selection because the kind of student that's going to stay with their faith is going to opt into those things. But even so, you had a big period where there was nothing. Like they didn't have either. That has to have had a big effect in context like yours. I want you to keep talking about you alluded to COVID and the way that it affected lots of churches, obviously, yours specifically. What percentage of people in your city would you say casually dechurched or went adrift during the COVID era? And what have you done to try to regather some of those people?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. What I can say with a high level of certainty is that at our church during the pandemic period, about 34% of our church dechurched. And just pastorally, I can say that was not in large part because of church hurt or some of these culture warring issues. It was a quiet dechurching. I think about a woman who I just saw at church a few weeks ago, and she came up to me and she said, I haven't been to church in 2 years. I haven't been here since COVID happened, and I'm so glad that I'm back. Now, we implemented some strategies to actually reach people and try to re-engage them because Mike was giving me this data, and I realized we had to be really intentional about drawing people back in. But of course, the problem is more broad in our community. We realize there's lots of de-churched people in Columbia, and we have to draw them back in. And maybe one encouraging factor here is that while we lost 34% of the church during the COVID period to this kind of casual de-churching phenomenon, the opposite has also happened. We've brought in a little over 40% new people in the interim. So, I mean, to try to put numbers on this, this essentially means that if you had 100 people at our church, about 34 of them we didn't see again. And yet somehow through some of the strategies I think we put into play and obviously God's providence working in people's lives, we've seen an additional 40 plus people arrive. But here's one of the keys. The people you're losing aren't always the exact same kinds of people that you're bringing in, right? You might be losing people who were in small groups and they were serving and they were giving and they were really embedded in the life of the church. And the people that we're bringing in, they're very much so in process. In my experience, they might be battling some mental health issues. You know, they've battled with depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation. Many of them are coming from some, like you said earlier, Mike, broken family environments. And of course, that means that they come in with a certain level of hurt and needs that we have to meet. And their process of getting involved, of serving, of worshiping consistently, of giving, that's a longer process than maybe those previous people who were there took to get there. Again, on one level, I'm really deeply saddened. I don't want to see anyone de-church. But on the other level, I have this deep sense of hope because we're actually seeing the church grow as a result of being intentional about reaching de-churched people in our community.
So everything that you're saying here, Patrick, definitely resonates, I think, pretty deeply with me and Jim. You know, we don't have as good of analytics on some of these things as what you do, but I would say anecdotally, a lot of the dynamics that you have seen, that you've seen there in Columbia, Missouri, have very much been true for us also in Orlando, Florida. And just in terms of the kind of the reshuffling of the deck. And I mean, I think some of these things are also just part of the Great Reset, as some have called it, just kind of culture-wide and, you know, in America as well. I wanted to just kind of drill down a little bit on what you said there on, you know, obviously you guys have been employing some tactics to just kind of put de-churching as dealing with de-church people in your city in a way that's has increased intentionality to it. What are some of the things that you guys have been doing and what seems to be resonating with people in your particular context?
Yeah. So there's a fantastic article on Mere Orthodoxy called The Four Quadrants of Church Life in the Gray Zone. How's that for a title? By Dave Strunk and Ben Ryack. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name right. But one of the points they make is that looking at the post-COVID world, there are two kinds of commitments that seem to be doing really well. And that would be low time commitment, low risk commitments. So low time, low risk. And then interestingly, the exact opposite, high time, high risk. So in the secular world, you could look at things like CrossFit and homeschooling or kind of the resurgence of homeschooling. Those are high risk, high time commitment things. But on the low risk, low time commitment thing, you can think about following an influencer or engaging with someone online. Now, again, for the average church, they might see this as a real obstacle because what we all in the church world tend to be really good at is hitting smack in the middle, right? It's kind of halfway between low time commitment and high, kind of halfway between high risk and low risk. And so what we realized is that we needed, at least at this stage, to focus a lot of time and energy on the low time commitment and low risk, because we're talking about re-engaging people. People don't go from zero to 60. And so the way we did that was we actually went through our church database and we began to segment out groups of people, and we were able to identify people who hadn't re-engaged and what ministries they had previously been engaged with. And we gave those email lists to ministry leaders and we said, hey, what can we do to bring them in? So here's a great example of that. Our women's ministry, we have a fantastic women's ministry at our church. And they had a good list of people who simply had not come back to anything involving our church or women's ministry in general. And we gave them the list of people who were there. And so they created a very low commitment, low risk event. It was a little painting event. It was a one-off event. Come in, we're going to paint together. We're going to have some tea. Again, low risk, low time commitment, just an hour. And they invited women on that list to come in. And they've repeated this, by the way, several times. And this has led to, so far as I can tell, well over 100 people who would have just casually de-churched. They would have just disappeared off the map of our church life. They've re-engaged. And the stories were really moving. I mean, we had multiple women come in who said, man, I haven't been in a big space like this since COVID. I haven't been back to church since COVID. But now that I'm sitting here and I'm with community and I'm seeing my friends and I feel reconnected, I realized I was longing for this. I desperately wanted to be a part of it. And so those are some of the strategies that we've really been implementing on a church level. But we've also been intentional about doing that on a more local level. We've gotten pretty good at figuring out how to target de-churched people online. So this is using things like Meta's ad platform and Google's ad platform and targeting ads to people that are inviting them again into low risk, low commitment things. So it's things like, hey, it's the Christmas season. We've produced a little Advent devotional that goes straight to your email. Well, the average de-church person, they aren't closed off to spiritual things. And they think, gosh, I haven't been to church in a while. I miss that connection to God. I could do an email devotional. And what's wild is that 10% of the people that we reach locally with those kinds of very low commitment, low risk things, 10% of them will show up in person over the next year. And what's even more exciting than that is of those people who show up, about 80 to 90% of them stay connected as time goes on. And so we're trying, you know, people see technology as a real obstacle to, I think, maybe the de-churching or deconstruction or whatever phenomenon you're talking about. And we've really taken the opposite tack and said, no, technology is the gateway to getting them into these low time commitment, low risk situations so they can re-embed themselves in community. And then from that point forward, we can take them on a journey towards deeper relationship, a deeper walk with God alongside our church community.
Well, let's stay with that technology stream for a minute. The good faith debates that you participated in, the argument that you and Jay Kim engaged in was, should a church be quick or slow to embrace new technology? And honestly, you guys just nailed it. I mean, I thought it was so helpful, so thoughtful, so charitable. I imagine that it'll be widely listened to as any debate that doesn't have Jen Wilkin in it, probably. But you did a great job. So I want to pull on this thread a little bit since you brought up technology. What are other ways that either you're using technology to reach the church? What are some things the church is doing poorly about embracing technology? Because I know from knowing you, you're not. I love what you say about replacement versus the alternative. So how should churches think about technology as a way to engage the casually de-churched?
Well, I know that what I'm about to say is going to sound counterintuitive, because Mike already said that one of the things that can lead to casual de-churching is watching church online exclusively. Now, that goes to the point you just made, which is I do not think that the internet or digital technology can replace what we do together collectively in worship. That's not the goal. I do, however, think that it has a tremendous power to enhance it. There's a fantastic article in Compact Magazine by a guy named John Askinos. Again, don't know if I'm saying his name right. But he makes the point that technology has a tendency to liquidate tradition. You can think about this with farming, right? You just go back 100 years, and what did farmers have to do to have a good plot of land, they had to do crop rotation. But then once you get to the 1940s and 1950s and the introduction of chemical pesticides and chemical fertilizers, you no longer had to do crop rotation. And so that's a major change to the traditional life, to the traditional form of farming. Now, what John says, and I think he's right, is we can see this as an obstacle, as a problem. We need to go backwards. You know, maybe we should be Amish or Luddite and just kind of go back to the world before technology that changed our traditions. But he says we need to have a different orientation towards technology. We need to see technology as something that can reinvigorate and re-energize our institutions. And that's my encouragement to church leaders. Yes, you cannot replace what you do on Sunday morning or what you're doing in small groups or service. So many of the things that the church does, you cannot replace it with technology. However, you can radically enhance it. And you can, as we're experiencing, I mean, again, we've brought something like 1,200 new people into our church using technology. That's the thing that brought them in. Now, that's not the end of it. Again, they have to come, they're going to get involved, but that's the beginning of it. And I don't think any of this takes a rocket scientist to understand. You know, I think there's a few great examples you could look at. I'll go outside of our church. There's a church in Nebraska called Coram Deo. And one of the things they do is they have a midweek podcast where they discuss in a little more depth what they talked about on Sunday morning. And so they see this as kind of a Christian education discipleship tool. And here's the beauty of that. Again, 100, 200 years ago, people could only go to their local church, the local parish church, wherever they could walk to. And there was a beauty to that because a pastor could walk around the neighborhood, go inside the office, you know, connect with people where they were living. And I see technology as a new opportunity to be in the everyday lives of people. We do that by creating little 10-minute devotionals. We do 4 a week. And that's a way that people, I mean, people tell me, they're like, I was out running on the trail and I was listening to this podcast. And it has the inverse effect also of you'd be surprised the amount of people who de-churched previously who said, I've been listening to this podcast, I've been learning on it. And that's what actually pushed me and pressed me towards coming back to church in person. So we can't see these things as in opposition to one another. Let's not replace, but let's enhance.
Well, and what's interesting to me and makes sense when we talk about the reasons that this kind of technology works. Now, of course, I don't want to, you've got the role of the Holy Spirit calling, lots of things. But what we are seeing in our study is that these de-churched evangelicals specifically are very willing to come back to church. We said in a previous episode, 51% think they will go back to church. A large portion of those are the casually de-churched. And we're going to jump into the data here in a second with Mike. But as I started to have these categories more clearly in my mind, it was shocking to me that these people need, like, what they really need is a nudge. You know, it's kind of like people who, you know, I've had seasons where I don't go to the gym, but I know I need it. I desire to go back. And really all it took was somebody inviting me. Yesterday, I got my teeth cleaned and I was asking the dental hygienist about, her, you know, she go to church, and I quickly realized she's in this casually de-churched category. One invite. And she was like, yep, we're going to do it. We're coming. We don't even know each other that well. And so it makes sense to me that technology would be this low-hanging fruit if there's already this disposition. So with that in mind, Mike, we talked in episode 2 with Ryan Burge about the machine learning, the 6 different profiles y'all developed in the different types of de-church person. If you haven't listened to that episode, I really recommend going back and listening. But you also did a deep dive on those who are casually de-church, understanding their animating concerns, their needs, ways the church can engage them. So as a next step of this conversation, would you flesh that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, of those 6 profiles, 4 of those profiles are de-churched evangelicals. So I want to really just kind of primarily speak to the 4 de-churched evangelical categories. So of 2 of those 4 profiles, most of those 2 are, like, the first 2 of those 4 profiles are de-churched evangelicals are people who you would call primarily casually de-churched. So again, you can go back to episode 2 with Ryan Burge to learn more about those particular groups. But we called those groups cultural Christians, which is about half of de-churched evangelicals, and then 1/6 of them are mainstream de-churched evangelicals. probably also about half of the fourth group, which we called the BIPOC group, which is a group that's comprised entirely of non-white persons, is more casually de-churched. And then the fourth category there of ex-evangelicals, that group is entirely de-churched casualties. So overall, about 75% of the de-churched evangelicals are of the casual variety. Same with the broader trends. So there's, again, there's nuance in both in episode two and then when our book comes out in, you know, kind of summer of 2023, you can, you know, read in much, much more granular detail about each of these different things and what it looks like to, you know, engage with each of these things. I'm going to paint in really broad brush strokes here. So like we mentioned earlier, these folks didn't have tremendous pain, church hurt, abuse, horrible experiences. They're just kind of adrift because they moved because of COVID, travel, baseball, laziness, golf course, that kind of stuff. Here's the big thing. The biggest thing that this group of people, 75% of, you know, the de-churched people, we're talking 30 million people, okay? Here's what they need. They need close friendship that results in invitations to church, that results in follow-up with discipleship. It's that simple. Close friendship, which results in invitations to church, which results in a long arc of discipleship. Let me double-click on kind of each of those things. Before I do that, I think of the de-church casualties, I think what you'll experience is three different types of casually de-church people's responses. One group, as Jim mentioned, like the dental hygienist from yesterday, they just need a nudge. A second group, they need to be at your dinner table before they're ready. And then a third group are going to be very reluctant, and they might, you know, put you off forever, and they might, or they might just take years of consistent things. So, you know, you're just going to have to use relational wisdom to know the difference between those two things. The person that needs a nudge, the person that needs to be at the dinner table, and the person who just needs years of really consistent relationship. But let me drill down kind of on each of those things. Close friendship, invitation to church, discipleship. So with respect to close friendship, you have to employ relational wisdom, okay? We'll have a whole episode here in 3 weeks from now on relational wisdom. Relational wisdom is what helps people experience you as calm, non-anxious, and curious. The kinds of things that you would want from like a really excellent counselor, right? Well, those kinds of skills and traits, they're not that complicated. You just have to have a level of security in yourself and knowledge that we have a God who's good in control. And if you possess those things, then we have a lot of comfort in moving into other people's lives and just being excellent, active listeners. Ask good questions, be quiet, and then let people tell you what they care about. Let them tell you about what their vision of truth, what their vision of goodness, and what their vision of beauty is. And when people experience you as being calm, non-anxious, and having a curious posture, it creates an environment of infectious relationship building. And that's the soil that's, you know, that's key for being effective for people, especially the people who need a little bit more than a nudge. The person who needs to be at your dinner table before they're ready to, you know, see an invite to church, or the person who just needs years of, you know, faithful, consistent, you know, genuine, good faith, you know, not bait and switch. You know, we're not in relationship with any of these people because, you know, they're a project or anything like that. We're doing these things because every human being that you interact with is an immortal creature that is made in the image of God, and we should be curious about everybody. So that's the close friendship piece. It really requires relational wisdom. The second piece is invitations to church. Ideally, it shouldn't be, you know, any church. You know, one of the things that we learned among our study was basically the value among this group for consistency and ethics. So ideally you're inviting somebody to church that has a high value of not just, you know, the truth of the gospel, or not just the goodness of the gospel, or not just the beauty of the gospel, really all three of those things at the same time. And then finally, discipleship. We don't want to just like invite people, you know, to church, you know, one off and just kind of forget about them. Those people are definitely going to be at risk of dechurching again. So we definitely want to have some kind of plan for them to grow emotionally, relationally, and intellectually.
It is so interesting to me, the low-hanging fruit that we see before us. So, Patrick, if it's not already clear from everything that we've said so far, make this really clear for the listener. In what sense should we interpret it as good news that so many of the 15 million people who have dechurched, left evangelical churches, have done so casually? Why should we see that as hopeful?
I think it's incredibly hopeful for a number of reasons. One is, just to be frank, if you had to go to Europe, where it is inevitably years of relationship before anyone is going to ever step inside a church, or you can go to the United States, where you have 15 million people who are saying, I just need a relationship and a nudge and an invitation, and that's all it's going to take for you to reconnect me with God. Almost everybody, at least just on the surface level of what's easiest, you're going to say, I want to go to the place where we've got warm leads, where people are excited to hear more about this. But I think more broadly, it's that the answers here are relatively simple. I mean, I think about the book of Acts, and it talks about the apostles trying to be faithful in their own generation. I didn't get to choose what time I was born in. I am born here and now, and I'm being called to faithfulness in my generation. I have to trust the power of the Holy Spirit to work in people's lives, to draw them to Jesus. But I also have to be thoughtful and strategic to make the decisions that will actually invite them in. And that's the part that I kind of feel a real missional urgency around, which is that churches, you cannot reach casually de-church people by being casual yourself. If you don't have systems and structures in place to take people on the journey that Mike just described, you will not reach these people. And there's a lot of intentionality that can be built into this. I've already talked about creating on-ramps digitally to get people to come and be involved. But we go far further than that. You know, one choice we've made as a large church since the very beginning was we weren't going to view our church as a hub for everything that happens in someone's life. So for example, there's no sports leagues at our church. You can't come and do the Christian sports league. And I don't have a problem with Christian sports leagues, but that was intentional. Because what we wanted people in our church to do was go and be involved in the secular sports leagues where parents would sit alongside other parents and develop the kinds of relationships that you're describing so that there would be opportunities not just to grow a depth of relationship, but invite people into the story of Jesus. And so again, we have to be really intentional. We need to make sure that we're pushing our people out into the community actively to be involved in the lives of people who are de-churched or who aren't Christian at all. And then we also have to make sure that inside the church, we've built systems and structures so that people don't fall off the map. I mean, one of the things that we are really, really serious about is that we have a very specific journey that we want to make sure everyone who walks inside our doors goes on. And we are checking in with them at every point to make sure that they take the next step on that journey. And without that intentionality, like Mike just said, people would just de-church again. They would just fall off the map. I think it's a real tragedy. I've talked to multiple people who said, I'm looking for a church. I mean, this has happened. Someone looking for a church for 2 years and they've gone to multiple churches and they weren't quite sure which one was right. And they found one they liked and they told me, I just can't figure out how to get involved. And then they kind of figured it out and they realized, oh, for me to get connected in relationship, it's going to take me waiting another 9 months because that's the next open period for me to get connected. And I thought, you know, the church is doing its best. So I'm not trying to be critical, but if we don't create very specific avenues and ways for people to get connected when they're ready to get connected, we've already given up. And I get that maybe that presses against, you know, your staffing needs or whatever your specific values are. If we can emphasize process and say that we've got to create these open lanes and spaces for people to get connected, I think that, again, there's tremendous hope because they desperately want it. They want relationship. And that relationship, that sense of belonging, we can say just sociologically, will almost always inevitably lead to a deep sense of belief and trust and faith in Jesus. And of course, that's my goal at the end of it. I want people to have a life-giving relationship with Jesus. But that's not going to happen if I don't take my responsibility seriously, which is building these strategies and praying and trusting the Holy Spirit to work through them in His way to bring about the results He wants in the lives of everyday people.
Well, I love how you contrasted our context to like Western Europe. I lived in Italy for 5 years, and what you're saying is absolutely true. Anybody, everyone we saw who was not a Christian and eventually plugged into a church as a believer, it was years of relationship before they would ever step foot in. And then I contrast that, though, on the other side with my friends in East Asia, other places where there was a lot of fruit. People would come to faith, but the discipleship needs were just off the charts because they had no context for Jesus being the God-man, atonement, Trinity, these kinds of things, worship. And the people in our context already largely have that at least intellectual foundation, if not at a heart level. So I appreciate the way that you flesh that down. All right, I want to get talk about you personally, Patrick, on this issue. What are you doing personally in your regular rhythms to move into the lives of de-churched people in your city?
One of the temptations of anybody in our moment is to live a highly online life. And what I mean by that is we spend a lot of time on our phones. We spend a lot of time consuming content. We don't spend much time on actual people-to-people life outside of maybe work. And so in our lives, I think this looks like a lot of different things. One thing I encourage everyone to do is Christians should be invested in their local institutions. That could be the school board. That could be the PTA. That could be the local Rotary Club or the organization in your city that helps small businesses grow. There's so many different spaces for you to go and rub elbows, so to speak, with people who are de-churched or who aren't Christians. And that's how I've tried to live this out. You know, I've decided, you know, I've got a first grader. I'm going to be very involved in the life of my first grader's school. I'm on the school board for my first grader's school. And that's part of my value system, is saying that that's going to be one of the ways that I can connect with people and create relationships. But the other element is, I think, what Mike just said, which is table fellowship. If you look at the Gospel of Luke, it's almost like a movable meal. I mean, Jesus is just eating in one place after another place after another place. And so he modeled for us what it looks like to invite people into our houses or to go into the houses of other people and have hospitable meals where you get below just the, you know, ordinary swimming level of, hey, we're talking about weather and sports and all the basics. And we actually start scuba diving. We get deep into people's lives and we show a real curiosity about who they are and why are they wired the way that they're wired and why do they believe what they believe, you know? And so it can be exhausting. And by the way, very expensive. My wife and I joke, we're like, we could save so much money if we were way less hospitable. That would be the number one way for us to grow our savings account. But I am more than happy to expend resources trying to give people extravagant experiences in my house. I mean, I'm not saying actual extravagant, but I wanted them to have amazing experiences in my house so that it creates doorways for them to want to come and be a part of our church. So again, that's how I try to live this out personally. I think it looks different in everybody's environment. I mean, if you're in the workplace and you're building relationships with people there, get those people into your house. Be the one person at your work who says, hey, this relationship doesn't stop after the 9 to 5 ends. You're going to be a part of my life. I'm going to know your kids. I'll know the quirks. I'll know the funny things about them, because that's going to be the bridge that allows you to invite them to be a part of your Jesus community.
Well, you made me think about, I was talking to a pastor who is really globally known for evangelism and discipleship and getting the gospel where it's not. And I asked this pastor, like, what does evangelism look like for you personally? And he said, my gym. Like, it's my gym. It's, you know, it's a class type workout gym. And he's like, I'm with the same people every day. Bad things are going to happen in their lives, because it does for all of us. And there's trust. They've been in my home. And it was just this regular rhythm, like you're saying, of being around people, inviting them in your home, and being there for them when they need it the most to be able to communicate, this is why we need Jesus. And he has a variety of different casually de-churched and church casualties there, and unchurched in his context. All right, so I want to transition from you to your church. What is your church doing corporately to help equip them, your church leadership, to equip your people to be able to engage de-churched people in your city more effectively?
Well, again, I think there's some really good news here because, if there's 15 million people who are casually de-churched, who are still very open to coming back to church, you don't need to develop apologetics experts who can defend the faith and give a 10-point reason why we believe in God and we aren't atheists. I mean, that's all wonderful stuff. I'm not against that. Here's what they have to be. They have to be people whose lives exude the goodness, the truth, and the beauty of who Jesus is, such that people see what they have, and obviously they're interested in it. They want to know more. And so I think part of it actually always has to be discipleship. I already talked about that high commitment, high time aspect. We're very intentional about creating spaces where we are discipling people deeply. We call it our leader track. You can call it whatever you want to call it, but this is it's a 1 year long commitment where we have small groups of people who are intensely meeting week after week after week. There's Christian education involved. There's heart-oriented stuff, hand-oriented stuff. How do you live? How do you feel? And again, what's the goal? Well, we're training them to be leaders. And that doesn't merely mean a small group leader. That means being a leader in your community, the kind of person who is drawing people to Jesus. Again, I think the other half of what we do, though, is what I already mentioned. We've made very intentional decisions to not make our church the hub of life. The church has a lot of value, right? We let's gather together and worship. Let's meet together in small groups. Let's serve alongside one another, but we won't be the hub. And actually, service is a fascinating example of this. We've made the choice that a lot of our serving isn't going to primarily be housed inside the church. Instead, we've partnered with a very large number of organizations. And I love this because if you went to these organizations and you said, hey, how would things go for you if the Crossing just closed down shop tomorrow? They'd say, well, we'd lose 70% of our volunteers. We'd probably lose 70% of our funding. That would be very, very bad for us. And the beauty of it is, if you come to Columbia and you're a refugee, there's a good chance that the very first person you will meet is someone who goes to our church. If you're a single mom and you're looking for services, you're looking for support, you are just in desperate need of help because your life is overwhelming, there's a very good chance that one of the first people you'll meet is someone who goes to our church. If you're homeless, you're looking for housing, you're trying to get job training, there's a very good chance that the very first person you'll meet who's going to help you goes to our church. Now, that's not happening inside of our church building. It's happening out inside of the city. It's happening out inside of the community. And so again, we're just very intentional. We want to push people. We want people to come in, but then we push people out to go live out the gospel in a beautiful, good, just, wonderful way that creates avenues for people to come in. And I love it because if you come to our church, you're going to meet a lot of ex-cons because guess what? You know, if you're coming on parole, you're going to meet someone from our church. You're going to meet a lot of refugees. You're going to meet a lot of people who are coming from homeless backgrounds, single moms. You're going to find people who are hurting there, which is also, by the way, wonderful if you want to reach de-church people, because if a lot of those people are hurting, they're from broken families. If they come into your church and everybody's just a buttoned up nuclear family and no one looks like them and no one has a lifestyle like them, they're not going to feel welcome. Well, I'll tell you what, you come into our church, you're going to see a lot of people who will make you feel really welcome because it is a mix of socioeconomic, of ethnic backgrounds, all the things that you would want to see in a church. But the only reason that has happened is because we haven't made ourselves the hub. It's because we've been very intentional about pushing people out and equipping them to invite people to church, to love people well.
Well, I think every listener can see why we invited you on the podcast for this episode. But I do want to say, as we finish, the goal here isn't that after this one podcast, everybody would be equipped to reach the casually de-churched. Our main goal is to introduce this category of casually de-churched. So when we meet somebody, we can understand what it is we're interacting with. We're going to talk more about church casualties. It's a whole different thing. But we're all three of us too, we're coming on the show, even though I would say Patrick is a little farther down the line, we're learners. We want to start a national conversation. We want to learn from each other. And I just really appreciate everything that you've done. Patrick, I want to commend to the listeners your debate that came out back in February on technology with the Gospel Coalition Good Faith Debates, Truth Over Tribe podcast, Truth Over Tribe book. We are really thankful for the work that you're doing for the kingdom here and look forward to seeing what all the Lord has in your future.
Thanks so much for having me. And I can only reciprocate the thankfulness, because I think the project that you guys are on right now and the data that you're giving us is really giving ministry leaders like me and ministry leaders across the country the tools they need to respond appropriately to the moment, which I would have never done had I not known this. So what you're doing is so important for the church reaching people in America.
Well, thanks. Well, stick with us, everybody, as we continue to develop the great dechurching, as we call it, the largest and fastest shift, religious shift in the history of our country. Look forward to more time together. Blessings.